Blog Talk Radio.
And now, live from the Sunshine Capital of America, the David Bowers Awards in beautiful Naples, Florida, with your host, the David Bowers, and special guest, James Arena, author of Divas of Disco, plus Alta Anderson, formerly of Chic, Joe Harris of Double Exposure, and the one and only white boy still playing that funky music, Rob Parisi. Also, we've got Bill Rock, host of Elvis Radio on Sirius XM, as he holds class on Rockstar 101, as well as our entire crew here at the Asylum, including our newest addition, Nick the Geek, our engineer extraordinaire, whose company, Jungle Productions, is making the high quality of this show possible today. And me, I'm John Bon Jovial, and now, the voice that can't carry a tune in a basket or a casket, the David Bowers. Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here today. And I want to first apologize to all our listeners and our guests who are expecting us to be here an hour early. Apparently, Blog Talk Radio's computers couldn't handle the time change, because after all that talk about making sure we got our sleep and got up an hour early today and had the clock set and everything, we encountered some kind of a difficulty that pushed us back an hour. So we managed to stay awake that extra hour, and here we are. We're glad to be here, and we're so glad that you are here with us. I want to take a second to thank our good friend and guest a little bit later on the show, Rob Parisi, for telling me that today is National Panic Day, so that I'd be sure and panic when all of these technical difficulties appeared. And sometime later today, I will catch my breath, maybe catch a breath and breathe or something really exciting like that. But in the meanwhile, we're ready to go. We've got a fun show for you today. We've got James Arena, the author of two books on the fabulous disco era, which has transformed into today's modern dance music era. And, of course, our special guests musically, Joe Harris, Alta Anderson, and the one and only Rob Parisi, who will be joining us a little bit later also. As John Bon Jovial said, we'll have Bill Rock, the voice of Elvis Radio on Sirius XM, as well as the voice you've heard for years on NBC TV. Bill Rock will be joining us for Rockstar 101. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank also our house band, Pity Bingo, for our theme music. Be sure and check out their latest CD, Live at Pedernales, some good old-fashioned Texas kick-ass rock and roll. And remember, this is the David Bowers Award Show, where everybody can give an award.
Everybody
gets an award. There's no funky nominating committees. Absolutely everybody. You just have someone you want to give an award to, send us an email to david@thedavidbowers.com. Put awards in the subject line. Tell us who or what you'd like to award. And who knows, you may get to hear it on the radio on your computer. So with that said, moving right along, just when you think that we've managed to cover all the awards and that there just can't possibly be any more awards, find out that, guess what? You're wrong. There's going to be more award shows. That's right. We've got more award shows coming up, and I'm not sure if this is the end of one award season or the beginning of another award season, but look out. More to come. That's right. There are more to come.
Yes, and
welcome the iHeart. The iHeart Music Awards. Yes, friends, we've got the iHeart Music Awards coming up very soon. It seems like everybody's got one. The iHeart Music Awards kind of copies the David Bowers Awards and lets the listeners determine the awards, allegedly, supposedly the artists you thumb up on iHeartRadio, The stations you create with your tweets and the posts on Shazam and Facebook determine the nominees, and then your votes will pick the winners. This should be interesting.
The thing that
we'll
I need to know, David. The thing,
John Bon Jovi?
The thing that I need to know is that with all these award shows, is this the end of our society as we know it?
Well, I guess that would depend on your definition of society.
Well, if you're heading it up, I don't know.
Yeah, well, just remember, you and Nick the Geek are part of my committee here, so I think this is going to be real interesting, and we'll
find out.
I don't know if
part of the committee or part of the committed.
I think we should all be committed, but nevertheless, we will find out through the friends of our good friend Mr. Bill Rock, will be joining us later because the awards, the iHeart Music Awards, will be televised May 1st on Guess What TV Network?
CBS.
This is your cue. Say NBC.
Excuse me. NBC. Did I say CBS? Who are they? I've never heard of them. NBC, the Natural Broadcasting Company.
Tryouts for my new announcer will begin right after the show. Remember, if you've got someone you think deserves an award, email David at thedavidbowers.com. Put awards in the subject line. Also want to note our previous guests, the rockers from Milan, Italy, Rev Angel, have a new single coming out this week. You can be among the first to preview that when it's released Friday in a special online-only release. Go to revangel.com/P as in Peter, R, Robert W. William, _SNG.PHP. And if that's too much for you to swallow, watch for my posts online because I'll be posting it up a little later. Or just drop me an email at david@thedavidbowers.com. John Bon Jovial.
Yes, sir.
Now, having reached that point, what's next?
Well, I guess, David, today we've got ourselves a pretty good show lined up. Actually, let me revise that. I think we've got ourselves a truly excellent show lined up, and I had spoken a little earlier with our guests, and everybody was understanding about the glitch with the time change, and we want to thank them very much for that. But our first guest today is a gentleman who is an author extraordinaire and pretty much a master of knowledge when it comes to all things pop music, particularly the disco scene, the disco era, and his name is James Arena.
All right, then, without any further ado, let's bring him on board. Hello, James, are you there?
I am here. It's great to be on board. Thank you very much.
Welcome aboard, and thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, and you've got yourself a couple of excellent reads out there. I know I've been reading parts of the one that really cover and encompass the disco era in the United States, well, in the world for that matter. Let me ask you this. How did you come to start this project in the first place?
Well, you know, it really came about for two reasons. The primary one was just out of curiosity to learn more about these men and women who had been such big influences in my life. I really enjoyed disco music, and I guess that's not something everybody runs around and says, but I really did, and I continue to enjoy it to this day, and I wanted to learn a lot more about these people and their lives and what made them tick. I was just very curious, and I figured, you know, I looked around, there were no books anywhere about disco. There were a couple of books on the market about the era itself, but nothing about the artists, very few. Maybe a book here and there by an artist, but a book that looked at all of them collectively, nowhere to be found. So I said, you know what, there's a niche there, let me see if I can fill it with something good.
All right, well, you came out with your first book, and let's see if I've got the order straight. Now, that was Legends of Disco?
Now, the first book was First Ladies of Disco, and then
first
the second
ladies,
book that just
right.
came out is First Legends of Disco, but the ladies one came first.
There you go. Okay, and aside from the obvious ladies first, how did you determine this order? Was one precipitated by the other, or was this your plan all along? How did that come about?
You know, to tell you the truth, I didn't know if there would be a second book. The first book, I just focused on the women because it tends to be that women are more often associated with disco music, in my opinion, than men tend to be. There were so many great, great female singers back in the day performing this kind of music, and they had the right voice and energy and look to carry it off. Usually when you think of disco music, you think of people like Gloria Gaynor, Donna Summer, Claudia Barry, Sister Sledge, Bonnie Poynter, people like that. And so those were the ones that I wanted to focus on first in the first book, in the female book. And then in the second book, I realized there were a couple of women I still needed to speak to and a couple of men that were absolutely vital to the era and the contributions that were made during the disco time. So there you have two books.
Well, you brought up one point early on there that I had thought of. You made the comment that you thought there might not have been that much interest in the disco era, and I know I was fully prepared because we get a lot of mail, a lot of email notes and stuff and notes on Facebook in advance of our shows about our upcoming guests, and the one that I was expecting was some irate hardcore fan of another genre writing in, you know, with the usual complimentary sayings like disco sucks and things like that, and I was really very favorably surprised. Not only did I not get one single complaint about that, but there was a lot of favorable response, including got to meet a lot of people who are following us and listening along today that I had never heard from before. So obviously we're picking up some listeners that we didn't have, and there seems to be a lot of interest in the disco music. I think that goes without saying because of the as it has graduated into today's dance music phase, I think it's quite obvious that there is worldwide a large audience for disco or dance music.
I agree with you, and I think one of the things that's changed over the decades is there's no longer this severe segregation of music that there once was. Back in the 70s and early 80s, you know, disco was put off almost to the back of the bus, if you will, in terms of its respectability. I think what has happened over time is that all these forms of music have crossed over into each other, and I think there's a much, much better tolerance for different types of music today, and people can appreciate many different forms of music, including disco, which in the late 70s started to get a reputation as being a frivolous form of music, and I think today people are looking at that music and appreciating it a lot more, seeing the technical aspects of it, seeing the beauty of it in the orchestrations and in the vocal performances. I think it's coming to its own, and it has a lot more respectability now.
I think you're absolutely right. An interesting fact you pointed out about the segregation or, you know, the separation of styles of music, and we'll be discussing this a little later in Rockstar 101 with our guest Bill Rock, and that's the evolution of radio formatting as it plays into the music because, you know, back in the earlier days of radio, the 40s and into the 50s, there wasn't the segregation. You had music radio, and they played virtually all genres of music with, you know, possible restrictions of they didn't go too far overboard into one area. Of course, we had the era where there wasn't a lot of black music played on white radio in the very early days. But over the course of time, this has grown to where there is a genre-specific presentation. You have rock radio, you have rhythm and blues radio, you have jazz radio, and it became very segregated. And now it seems to be, as you just pointed out, going back to a more broad general presentation where you will have stations that will mix the genres as we have known them. You get pop and country crossovers, you get rhythm and blues, you get even get some hip-hop crossovers into the pop Stein, and you've got even country artists doing hip-hop. So there is a transformation, a growth going back to where a station will play all types of music. And speaking of music radio, my co-host, John Bon Jovial, is sitting here anxiously awaiting a chance to ask you a question, James. So, John, what have you got?
Well, yes, anxiously. James, first of all, thank you for being with us today. It's really great that you're here. But I wanted to ask you, you know, in regards to, you know, disco, which, of course, had its height of popularity in the late 70s and early 80s. But prior to that, you know, some musicians that maybe people would consider to be the pioneers of disco, such as Casey and the Sunshine Band or George McRae, where do you rate them as far as their influence on disco, and how, in your opinion, do you think they shaped the genre?
Well, you know, if you look at the artists that are in both of these books, you're going to get a cross-section of people who had major hits and maybe slightly less than major hits. Somebody like a Casey or a George McRae, well, they literally sold millions upon millions of copies of their records. Their sounds broke through the barrier of making disco music, not just this little niche that was out there, but mainstream pop music. They helped to bring it into the top 40 and then into the top 10. So I think they were extremely influential people. When you have other artists, like take a Carol Williams from the first book, First Ladies of Disco. She was one of the first female vocalists on the Sal Soul label, and her music is absolutely striking and beautiful, and she, I think, made just as much a contribution to the genre. Each of these artists have something really incredible in their backgrounds, and I think when you read the chapters in these books and learn more about them and what they went through and what they experienced, it really is fascinating information, and I think most of it is not generally that well known.
Well, okay, and you know, that's, I was kind of hoping that you would say just exactly what you did, because I would take a look at, I mean, first of all, and myself, you know, back in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, I was in country radio, I was also in rock radio, and we didn't play a whole lot of disco. Matter of fact, you know, the whole mantra of anti-disco was very prevalent back then, you know, with us. But, you know, since then I have come to learn and appreciate the complexity of the music, and in some respects I do like it today more than I did back then. But the thing that struck me about some of these crossover artists, like you're talking about, particularly with Casey and the Sunshine Band, is that they had a real generous dose of rock and roll in their music, with the underlying pst, pst, kind of beat that is so typical of the dance clubs and disco of today. And, you know, upon thinking about that, you know, that's a pretty hard thing to do, to try to blend those two together to try to attract two completely diametrically opposed audiences.
You're right, and you want an even better example, I think, is one of your guests today, Rob Parisi of Wild Cherry. When they took the funk and rock elements, melded them together, and came up with Play That Funky Music, I think they helped to bridge a huge gap that had started to form between rockers and people who liked disco. And it's fascinating, but there really was no need for such controversy, and it's unfortunate that those aspects developed. You know what I think is the problem with disco? What I think happened is the market got saturated by disco records. There were just too many of them, and everybody was jumping on the bandwagon. Every radio station started playing almost too much of the genre, and I think people got a little burnt out on it. You also had crazy disco records, like Ethel Merman singing disco and Andy Williams and things like that, you know, and that then it
Dolly
became
Parton.
Kind of something to make fun of.
Yeah, even Dolly Parton got in on the act.
Dolly Parton, and I have great respect for the
big,
Village
big
People.
Record.
Yeah, and I have great respect for the Village People, who had some wonderful music as well, but their campy image also started to create a more lighthearted feel to the music, and I think people stopped taking it seriously, not because of them, but all these factors came together, and I think it hurt disco at times.
You had certain markets in the country, too, that were, you know, very far more influential on the music scene than say, Midwestern markets. In Los Angeles in particular, you had guys like Rick Dees, who, you know, he was playing just about every disco record that was thrown at him. And as far as,
and
you know, making
it,
yeah, making his own. You had parodies. You had bands like there was a country parody of it, Chuck Wagon and the Wheels, Disco Sucks, which was
disco
hardcore
sucks,
disco.
Right.
Hardcore disco.
Yeah, I really had to try hard to resist the temptation to play that here today.
But, you know, contrary to the name of the song, I mean, it was a very relevant genre. And even to this day, it still is, especially with some of the post-baby boomers.
It's true. Everything you're saying is true. And, you know, I think 40 years into the history of this genre now, I think we're seeing that it was a great form of music. Yes, it had its campy elements, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with having a funny song or having some laughs, too. But by and large, most of this music was really beautifully orchestrated, beautifully composed, and beautifully sung.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm glad I'm glad through these books I'm having an opportunity to maybe show people what went into making this music and how important it really is.
And you must have been, it must have been a thrilling and exciting experience for you to get not only to talk to these people, but to dig out the backstory, because there's just so much to be learned from them, not just in the music itself, but the history of their involvement in the music.
Well, you got that right. Let me tell you, the fact that I got to speak to, combined with the two books, 72 artists from this era, the best of the best, I can't even tell you what that was like for me. They trusted me to tell their stories properly and to allow them a platform to express their thoughts about the music and the things that they experienced. And I was honored, absolutely honored to do that. And I hope the books come across as a very warm and very affectionate tribute, homage to these great, great people. And I have to tell you, it really, no lie, it is the thrill of a lifetime for me. I never dreamed this could be possible to do. And just as a side note, I have lost my job. I'm over 50 years old, so I'm in the process of kind of reinventing myself. And that's when these books came along. So to me, this has been like a glorious new beginning. And I'm very grateful to each of these artists for allowing me a chance to do that.
Well, we know that we've got a lot of people that are in the music business that are listening to us. A lot of them will be looking for historians from time to time, and if we ever get the opportunity to pass your name along, rest assured we will.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that very much.
And we appreciate you sharing not only your books with us, but your contacts with these artists and your stories. So what we'd like to do at this point, I'd like to invite you to stay with us, stay on the line, on the phone with us, and perhaps you can interact with these guests that you have brought our way, and maybe bring out some of the more interesting facets that you came across in talking with them, if you'll do that, please.
I would be honored to. Thank you.
You're absolutely welcome, and the honor is entirely ours. In just a moment, we'll be introducing our first guest of the afternoon. We'll be right back. Moving on right now, our first guest will be coming up in just a moment. Before we do, we have another David Bowers Award that we'd like to present at this time. This is a personal award for me, and it's a birthday award. I'd like to wish a slightly belated. Unfortunately, we didn't have a show on her birthday, so we're going to take this moment now to issue the David Bowers Happy Birthday Award to Melanie Zaleski, listening out in Chandler, Arizona. Happy birthday, Melanie. Hope you have many more of them and that this is the beginning of a great year for you. Our first guest, up in a moment, his name's Joe Harris. He's an original member of a unique group that's not only a big part of disco history, but they actually ushered in a brand new era. We've mentioned occasionally, sometimes accidentally, records. In our discussions here, and for those of you too young to remember, they were round pieces of plastic that you used to put on a spinning turntable, move a needle over on it, and they played music. Now, strangely enough, these seem to be coming back into
it. Do I detect a note of sarcasm there?
No, but I just think it's kind of funny that it's not only something that's alien to kids today because they never had to deal with these things, but they are returning to prominence now. All of a sudden, people are starting to get interested in vinyl. More and more groups and artists are doing music on vinyl now than they have in several years. Matter of fact, our good friends the Oak Ridge Boys have an album coming out next month. I believe it's on Tax Day, April 15th, which is going to be their first ever live album. And that is available right now on pre-order. A little bit of a plug, but I don't mind plugging our friends. That is available right now on pre-order on vinyl, if you want the vinyl. So all of a sudden, records are making a comeback, and this next group that we're going to be bringing on here has a distinct place in not only music and disco history, but in recorded history. These people, this group, was responsible for the first publicly available, commercially available 12-inch disc. Now, those of you who worked in disco or in DJing in clubs back in the day, remember that we had the music come out on these big 12-inch discs. They were a foot across, and they were a lot easier to work with than those awkward little 45s. Plus, they could be slightly longer than those little 45s were. And when Double Exposure released their first album called 10%, they came out with a 12-inch disco version for the DJs in the clubs, but they also released it to the public. And that was the first 12-inch single that was released in the modern era for the general public, and you're going to get to hear all 7 minutes and 8 seconds of it right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Double Exposure and 10%. That's 10% by Double Exposure from the disco era long ago in a galaxy far away. And Thysia, you can relax for a minute. We're going to chat with Joe Harris. You can she's been dancing in the aisles here in the chat room. And if you don't think that's hard, try dancing in a chat room sometime. Thank you, Thysia. So glad to have you with us today. And Joe Harris, we're glad to have you with us today, too. How you doing?
And a galaxy far, far away, huh? Doing good, man.
Oh, great. So great to have you here with us today. And James, let me find him. James is here online, too. Are you with us, James?
I certainly am.
Okay. James is going to be joining us and helping us talk with you, Joe, because I want to get... I want to get James's insight to get maybe some of the backstory that, you know, I might miss a point or he might come up with something really relevant that he'd like to bring out. So first, why don't you tell us a little bit about your group, how you came to be and how you got involved in the disco thing?
Well, for us, actually, hey, James, how you doing?
I'm good, Joe. Good to hear from you.
I can tell them
you don't need any help telling your stories. You've got a great memory for this stuff. Just watch. This guy knows everything.
Yeah, we actually, we started singing together. I'm going to date myself, man. November 1961. And we started as kids in junior high school. And there was a break in between, a little military service, and when we got out, we vowed to get the group back together. We did, our roots is R&B. We were part of the Philly scene, that Philly R&B sound, you know.
A lot of
and,
good sounds.
Oh, that was such a classic sound, it was wonderful.
Yeah, well, yeah, we were part of that, because before that, we had recorded for Stax. And we were in the process of doing the album for Stax, and right when they went under, it had to be, around 72, 73 in that area?
Yeah, somewhere early to mid-70s, yeah.
Yeah. And what happened, personally, I was in Philly. I was downtown doing some shopping, and I heard somebody call my name. And I turned around, it was Norman Harris. Norman was one of the original members of the rhythm section for Gamble and Huff. You know, the party was one of the and MFSB and all that. You know, let me make a long story short. Norman, along with Ronnie Baker and Earl Young, had formed a production company. Norman had just signed a deal with Sal Soul to produce music for them, and they needed a group. They wanted to start filling out the roster. Well, Norman knew us from years ago, and when he seen me, he told me, man, nobody has been able to contact you guys. You know, we were around, but we were working jobs, working local gigs, just trying to make it. He said, look, be in my office tomorrow. I got an audition for you. Okay, cool. So I got everybody together. We were in Norman's office the next day. At the audition was all the staff writers, Bobby Eli, Vince Montana, and Al Felder, and Conway, and Kersey, all the crew, along with Ken Kerry from Sal Soul Records. We auditioned. Audition went well. Next thing you know, we went in the studio. When 10% actually was a song that they were going to use on somebody else. Conway and Al Felder wrote that song. They were going to use it on somebody else. They tried it on us. When they heard us sing it, they decided we were going to be the group to do that song because they felt that wasn't nobody else able to do it better. When we recorded that, we had no idea about what disco was. We had no clue. We didn't really know anything about that that movement until we went to New York. The record company brought us to New York. This was in, right around near the end of 75. And when we seen what was happening, we said, "Oh, buddy, something going on here," you know. So what
did you think? What was your initial impression of disco when you first heard of it, when you first discovered the genre, and then and you knew you were going to start getting involved in it? What thoughts were going through your heads at the time?
Hey, man, these people partying. They partying, man. They partying. So hey, I wanted to come to the party.
Well, and, you sure found a good way to do that.
Yeah, you know, and what happened, Southsoul just marketed our music that way, and we just, I look at it this way, we really were an R&B group. We just happened to have some music that fit, people liked it, and I'm glad they liked it, and the rest is history.
Well, you know, one thing I'd like to interrupt the train of thought here for just a second, because one of the hallmarks of our great show here, excuse me while I break my arm patting myself on the back of it, one of our features is the fact that we give out awards. Now, I'd like to know what or whom you would like to issue an award to today.
To all our fans and supporters over the years. You're talking over 50 years. And all the people who have supported Double Exposure. We were away for a while. We came back. We're starting to see fans bringing their kids to shows now. Some of the kids are getting into the music. And
that's one of the greatest things.
No, it's a generational thing. It's a great thing. Beautiful thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a great thing, and that's a great award, Joe. I thank you very much for saying that. And you guys are one of the acts that are doing it now. How much touring are you doing right now?
We not as much as we used to. Naturally, two reasons. Number one, there's not as many places to play. The venues just aren't there like they used to be.
That's true.
And,
there's a lot of truth in that.
And hey. Hey man, we're older, man. It's hard. That road can kill you for a lot of years.
That's
man. That road can take a toll on
you. That's one of the reasons we.
This is James here again. I just want to say that, you know, I've seen these guys perform, and they maybe they're older, but I'm telling you, they're not lacking in energy or vocal power. And you go see these guys, and you will be transported right back into the 70s. They do a great job. They have great voices, and you can see the passion in them when they perform their music. So don't let them fool you about that. They are right on their game today.
Hey, thanks.
Hey, I believe that. And, you know, when you get into it because you enjoy what you're doing and you stay with it because of that, you're almost always on your game. Right now we've got a caller on the line who may have a question or something here for us. Let's check in with Raider Nation 677. Hello there.
Hey, guys. Is my Uncle Kevin there?
We don't have Kevin on yet. We can get both of you in there. That's not a problem.
Yeah, can you bring my Uncle Kevin on, please?
Okay. Uncle Kevin, are you there?
Hey, howdy there, fellas. How are you? Hey, Joe.
Hey, Uncle Kevin.
Okay, do you guys have a question for either of our guests here, James Arena or Joe Harris?
Well, I don't know about Mark, but I have a question for Joe Harris, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to know how big his dick was, or if he ever fingers his
asshole.
Oh, for
Christ's sake, we got to get rid of they're gone. They're gone.
Okay. Always one, huh?
Yeah, we had a couple of
James, if you're still there.
I'm still here.
James?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Let me ask you this now: when you talked with Joe and the guys about their involvement in disco, what was one of the points that came out that may have surprised you, caught you off guard, or was especially significant to you?
You know, I think one of the things that impressed me the most about them was, and Joe, just correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it's the fact that they're all still together. It's the original group from back in the day, and they stuck together through thick and thin, and that they treat each other like brothers. When I was speaking to Joe and Leonard for the book, they were, I could hear the camaraderie between them, and you could feel it. It was palpable. They have a great love for each other, and the whole group is like that. And I was really impressed and moved by that. Very professional people and very dedicated, honest, hardworking. They just have, it's funny, Joe mentioned that he's started off in soul and R&B music, and that's really what they consider themselves, and they actually have so much soul. When you talk to them, you can hear the sincerity in their voices. It's just great that they're all still together and they're still performing as a team, and I think that was the thing that moved me the most in speaking with them.
And that's been a recurring theme with guests we've had on the show, and we've had some that have been together quite a while. We've had the Oak Ridge Boys, of course, who have been together, four decades now, or five? It's been a while in the current configuration, I know. And, of course, an oldies group that's still going strong today is the Mystics. And Joe and Phil are two of the original members of that group from back in the 1950s, and they echo the same sentiments. It's the fact, one, they love what they're doing. Two, they love each other. And it really comes through. Joe, it comes through with you guys, the sound, the fact that you just enjoy what you're doing, and that is so important.
Hey, man, we're a family. I know myself personally, I guess the guys would say the same thing. I love performing. I mean, I love getting on the stage, man. I love the feedback. The music business is another story and leaves something to be desired. But the performing live for people, that's what I love, man. Like I said, the business itself, that's a whole nother animal. So you can understand what I'm saying.
I know exactly where you're coming from. And, yeah, there are some facets of the music business that they make it a job, but again, if you enjoy what you're doing, and you guys obviously do, it's never really a job, and you can deal with some of the things that normally would be a turnoff. You just sort of work around them and keep moving on. So you said you're not performing as often now because you're more or less enjoying life. What do you have? Do you have any performances coming up this summer?
Well, we actually have a performance coming up week after next, March the 22nd in Staten Island. There's a reunion for the Club Pastels. I believe
All right.
It's in Brooklyn. Yeah. They're having a reunion at the Z2 Lounge in Staten Island on Veterans Road West. Matter of fact, I'm reading the clip right now. It's Veterans Road West, March 22nd, and we're going to be there. As a matter of fact, it was so funny, flattering, I'd say, that we found out that they had a poll. They have a club or organization. They had a poll on who they wanted to perform for their event, and we got the vote.
Oh, fantastic! And to all my listeners out in New York City, we've got a bunch of listeners up there in New York. I know Blazin' Rye, who has an online show, is a listener of ours. As a matter of fact, if you're going up that way, you might get a hold of Blazin' Rye, and I'm sure he'd be glad to have you as a guest on his show, and you can talk about the upcoming event. Tell us once again, just so we get it straight. Now, this is coming up a little later in March.
March 22nd, it's a Saturday, March 22nd at the Z2 Lounge, 2925 Veterans Road West, Staten Island, New York.
Fantastic. You be sure and get me the information, and we'll pass it on our posts on the social media and our web posting sites, and get a good crowd out there for you guys. Want to take a second to thank you so much for being with us today, and wish
hey,
you all
you
a luck in the world.
Me,
you guys have just done such a great job over the years, and we're really proud and honored to have you come and spend a few minutes with us here on the show.
All right, hey, appreciate it.
You know, one comment that I want to add, David, is that you know, Joe, your music, you know, through the years has always brought back, you know, when I hear something by Double Exposure, you know, it reminds me of, you know, things that have gone on in private with, you know, me and you know, the woman that I love at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I just want to thank you for that.
Hey, no problem.
Alrighty.
You've made life a pleasure, sir.
Okay, all right.
Keep on dancing. Thank you so much, Joe Harris.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Moving right along here with a little bit of transitional music by the artist that is currently known as Jafefa. Before we get to our next guest, which will be in just about on about 60 seconds, John, I want to take a moment to pay the bills and talk about our good friends at Computer Help USA. Yes, sir, and we need to pay the bills, as you say. Computer Help USA is a full-service computer facility serving not only the local Southwest Florida Naples area, but also nationwide through remote servicing of your computer by connecting directly to you via the internet, taking over your computer and affecting the repairs and changes that need to be made so your computer can stay secure and safe against viruses and a lot of those, well, all of those ne'er-do-wells that are out there that are just chomping at the bit to steal your personal information. That's Computer Help USA. You can get a hold of them on the internet by going to www.comphelpusa.com. You can contact them via email at support@comphelpusa.com or give them a call, and their phone number is area code 239-596-6112. That's Computer Help USA, and through their generosity and gracious attitude, they'll allow us to use their studios every month here to broadcast the David Bowers Awards. And then next on the list, we want to tell you all about Jungle Productions and Nick Rogers, who is the head of the establishment. Jungle Productions, they are a 64-track Pro Tools high-definition recording studio, and they will specialize in all genres of music and voiceover engineering and mixing on-site by head engineer Nick Rogers. They have on-call original compositions for your media project. Nick has a full-sale educated, multiply credited, engineer on both sound and video. And they have released in 2012 their Sonic Pictures by Drew Connor. And in 2014, you can look forward to the release of Cargo of Congo Island, the highly anticipated follow-up to Sonic Pictures. So that's Jungle Productions. You can get a hold of them on Facebook and on the internet, on Google. Just look up Jungle Productions. David?
Thank you so much, John Bon Jovial. And with regard to Comp Help USA or Computer Help USA, I can vouch for them. They are not only a backer of this show, they have been maintaining my machines for, 10, 12 years now. It is amazing now that they can actually, some of the stuff they can do via direct connection through the internet, and they have done with me, and I know other clients as far away as Michigan and Colorado that I know of. They can not only set up and fix your computer, they can remove viruses, they can do all kinds of magical stuff to get your computer back up and running clean and safe, and they do it totally securely, disconnect afterwards, and you are back to where you were before. They're really good people, they know what they're doing, and they do it right the first time. Give them a try if you're having any kind of tech problems at all. They are good people. Moving right along, our next guest is bringing some more legends of disco to us, And we are going to bring her on right after we listen to this next song. That would be Alpha Anderson, formerly of Chic, and Good Times.
Good time.
Oh, and those were the good times. I remember when those records came out when I was in radio, and again, I'm going to use the term records because that's exactly what they were. And I remember so well, one of the biggest good times about it was it got rid of the 3 and 3.5 minute records and gave us 5, 6, 7, 8 minute records. And boy, was that a welcome relief when you were pulling an air shift of 4, 5, 6 hours locked in a control room. It gave you a chance to get a break and get up, walk around, and maybe even leave the room and go out to the Coke machine or something. But they were indeed some good times. And one of the ladies who brought us those good times is joining us right now, Alpha Anderson. Welcome aboard.
Thank you, David. A pleasure to be here with you.
And it is our pleasure to have you joining us. James is on the phone also, and he's helping us maybe dig out a little insight, too, because of his perspective of having been able to talk with you and go over those good times when you were recording with Chic and working with Nile Rodgers and back in the day. How did you enjoy those days?
They were actually magical days. I mean, they were not without moments of angst. And that basically was because of the way we recorded. You know, we would go into the studio. We would be told a time and a date to report to the studio, not knowing the songs in advance, not hearing them in advance. We would go in, and they'd give us a piece of paper, they'd put on the track, and they say, here's the song, okay, learn it, sing it.
you mean you didn't get these in advance and have time to rehearse them?
Never.
Oh,
never.
My gosh.
That
well, I
got to
tell
it.
You, you know, for just improvising off the cuff like that, lady, you got talent.
That makes it just all the more amazing. I was not aware. You know, logically, you know this stuff happens, and every now and then you hear the story about the artist who needed one more song and sat down, you know, with a beer and a cigarette out in the studio and scratched out a song, and later on it went to become a hit. That happens occasionally. But to have this as a regular way where you just walk in, they hand you something and say, okay, here we're going to record this, do it.
Right.
That's amazing.
That was the norm for us. So we would, you know, we would stand around in the control room with the engineers, and they would put it on speakers, and we would be handed a sheet of paper, and we'd listen to it, and they'd show us how it went. And then it was left to us to go out there and interpret that. So we learned how to work really quickly on our feet.
So with a song like Good Times, how many takes did that did you have to go through before it was just right?
Believe it or not, I don't remember there being a lot of takes, because what we would do, this was one of our group leads, you know. So one of the things that, so it was Fonzie, Michelle, Lucy, and me, and I think was Yolanda McCullough on this. I have to go back and check the liner notes. So what we would do is that we would stand in the control room, and we usually ask to start with the hook, because once you get the hook, that sort of provides the DNA for the song, and you can figure out where the groove is, you know, and where the nuances are. And we would work the nuances, and since it was unison singing, which, by the way, is a lot harder than singing in harmony, you know, we would work on it until our tones were unified, our approaches were unified, our breaths were unified. And then we would go out, start at the end of the song, get it, and then we could go back and do the rest of it.
Well, I guess so much for Dave Letterman's
time. Fine. Good luck, showboy.
What was that?
That was just one of Dave's comments. He tosses in occasionally here. So you girls must have really gotten close to each other to be able to work on a situation like that, where you had to actually be able to create the experience in the matter of a couple hours in the studio.
Yeah. Yeah, you did. I mean, it would take more than a couple of hours, you know, if you're judging two to be the standard of measurement. But it would be a session, you know, it would be just one session. And we did get close. We knew each other's voices. We knew each other's nuances. We knew who would sing what part. And one of the things that you had to know is we quickly learned what you had to offer and what you bring to the mix.
Absolutely.
And we would listen
Absolutely.
To the song. Yeah, and we would just all sing, and we would listen for the person who got it the quickest. And
okay,
inevitably, somebody
sense.
Always would get it quicker, and we would all move to that type of phrasing and pronunciation because when you heard it, you knew it exactly. And we would just automatically
right.
go there.
How long were you girls working together?
Well, I worked with Norma Jean Wright on the first tour as a backing vocalist. Luther Vandross and I provided background vocals on the first tour. And from then on, Lucy Martin and I worked until, you know, for the duration, until the group disbanded.
Wow. Wow. Now, you worked a lot with Nile Rodgers in those days, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, what... This is something that I know some of our listeners who are, you know, music students and historians are really interested in. What, because he's making a comeback now. I don't think you can really say a comeback. He's never really left the scene. The man is incredibly talented. What is he like to work with?
He is very, very precise about what he wants. And that's a sign of someone who knows what they want. And, you know, impeccable. So working with him was actually a pleasure. You know, you learned a lot from working with him. And like I said, the biggest thing for me is like going in there not knowing. You know, that was the hardest thing. But then you worked at it. And even in his preciseness, there were things that happened that were not perfect. But that was a part of it, too, because the perfection was in the imperfections. If
oh, I like
sense.
That. And I like that. That's yeah. that really hits the nail on the head.
Yeah, that's very, very good point. James
yeah,
Arena,
that's what
is there
was.
A point?
You know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Please go on.
No.
By all means, you go ahead.
You know, that's why to this day I still love analog over digital. Because you hear the
we've
humanness.
We've had people say that.
You know?
Yes, we've heard that from many artists that have been on the show, and that it is a definite difference, the fact that the sense, the feeling you get out of analog. And I think that also it points out the popularity of live recordings, because those live recordings, they're not all sterile like, you know, a digital studio recording where everything is precise. And
yeah.
it injects a human element. I know it's one of the things that we strive for here, why we rarely pre-record any segments unless we have to, just for the pure spontaneity of doing it live. It's something you can't put in a can.
You certainly can't, and I love that. I mean, there were things that went out that became hits that were actually mistakes. I mean, I remember when I was doing Le Freak with Diva Gray, and I did that together, and there was a phrase that I sang, and I sang it flat, and Diva said, oh, you know, she sang that flat, and Alan Bernard said, flat, are you kidding? We love that.
So, you know, I'm glad you brought up Le Freak, because that has a very special place in music and record history, too, in that Le Freak, from the time it came out and sold, I don't know, what was it, umpty million copies, that was the all-time biggest-selling record in Warner Brothers history until 1990, when a girl named Madonna came along with a thing called Vogue. So that's quite an accomplishment in itself.
Absolutely. I'm very proud of that, very proud to have been a part of that history.
James Arena, now you wrote the book, literally written a couple of them now on the disco era. Is there anything in particular about Alpha and her history that you would like to bring out?
I think what was interesting about Alpha was the change in direction that she took after the Chic years, she went on to have a very accomplished career in teaching in the New York school system, which I think is quite fascinating, and you'll probably have noticed already that she's extremely articulate and a very intelligent woman. And I think that shows that, you know, there's so much more to these people than just the fact that they sang disco or had some disco hits. Their lives are very interesting and varied, and I think Alf is a great example of that. And I think every chapter in both of the books, First Ladies of Disco, First Legends of Disco, I think you will find that true of every artist. But I think Alf is a real exceptional example of that kind of interesting background.
And she is such a pleasure to talk to. It's like what we try to create here on the show. It's the atmosphere of, I really feel, Alpha, in talking to you, that it's like we're sitting in the living room with a, you know, a cup of coffee, a drink or whatever, just talking, and it's very pleasant and comfortable talking to you. It's our pleasure, really, to have you on the show, and an honor, really. The only unfortunate thing is I can't get your autograph on the radio, so that's one of the things we have. That's one of the things we haven't mastered on this show yet, but believe me, if there's a way to do it, we will. Now, I did not know about your avocation or second career, whichever, as a teacher. What were you teaching?
Well, actually, I started as a teacher. You know, I got my master's from Columbia University's Teachers College, and I was teaching freshman English at Hunter College here in New York. And after Chic, I went back into education and got a second master's in school leadership and was a high school principal in New York City.
Really?
Good.
Great.
Yes. Wow.
So there you go, all you disco detractors out there in the world. Hey, we got some pretty smart people here in disco as well as some pretty nice ones. That is amazing. I am really impressed, Alpha. That is really impressive.
Yeah,
and what are you doing now?
Well, now, actually, I've retired from the Board of Education, you know, ended my career actually working for the board, actually, for the Director of Arts and Special Projects, helping to identify cultural arts partners for the schools so that we could have some great art in schools, because they've continued to cut arts funding. So one of the things I did was really marry my two loves, my love of music and the arts and my love of education. So I was able to do that. I still serve as an educational consultant with a program here, and I go out a few times a year and work with teachers and principals. But I'm also now beginning to let my first love, my artistic love for music, reemerge. So Norma Jean Wright, Lucy Martin, and I are going to be reuniting this year in a concert.
Oh,
wonderful.
Yeah.
News. That's fantastic news.
I am so happy. And actually, the concert was spawned by James Arena's book. Thank you so much, James. And we are doing a benefit for the AIDS Assistance Program in Palm Springs on May 3rd. So hopefully this will be the beginning of some more collaborations. We are looking to collaborate. And personally, I am also working on a new CD, a compilation of works, things that I've wanted to do. So
will you be coming to Florida?
I don't know. Let's find out. Let's make that happen. We would love to come to Florida.
Lucy lives
in Florida.
Really? Fantastic. Yes. And we would love to... We would love two things. We don't hesitate to have our guests do self-promotion of any kind. As a matter of fact, we encourage it. By the same token, we don't hold back either. So we would love to get a copy of the CD and have you come back on the show when you get ready to release it, and we'll help you get it started.
Oh, thank you so much. How kind. And I will certainly follow up with you.
By all means, my email is very easy for the world to remember. I made it easy for me to remember. David at thedavidbowers.com. Easy to remember. Stay in touch with us, because I'm really serious. We would love to have you come back and introduce both your personal and your group CD I think it's not only a chance to expose your new music, but to show what you're doing and see what you're doing now and what you're planning in the future. It's amazing. I'm really glad that you were able to be with us today, and I'm especially glad to find out about your new material that you're working on.
Thanks, David.
Thank you so much, Alpha. It's really a pleasure having you with us, and I do look forward to having you back again in the very near future. Thanks again. And thank you, James, for bringing Alpha on, as well as Joe Harris. And our next guest, who will be coming along in just a couple of moments, one Mr. Rob Parisi, who will be joining us. And, well, I don't have to tell you what he does. Everybody knows.
Here we go.
Caught me a little off guard there. I think that ended about 2.5 seconds faster than I thought it was going to. John Bon Jovial, are you with us?
I am here. I am making an announcement to the world that I, as of this moment, am right here.
Well, that's good, because that means if you're there, I'm here, and we are making absolutely no sense at all, so we must be having fun. Before we introduce our next guest, which I'll have you do in just a moment, John Bon Jovial, I want to take time for one more The David Bowers Award today. And while this doesn't have anything directly to do with music, I think it's important that we award not only for the good things, which we've already heard, but also for totally frivolous stupidity. And a California man is winning this award. I don't have his name, so we're going to give it to him anonymously. He's suing McDonald's. Now, we've all heard the story of the lady who sued McDonald's, one of those places, because she spilled coffee on her and was surprised to find out it was hot. But this one, I think, carries it even further. He is suing McDonald's because he received only one napkin with his meal. Believe it or not, true story, I don't make this stuff up. He said the incident happened last month when he ordered a quarter pounder and noticed that he only got one napkin with his burger, and claims that he emailed the general manager of the restaurant to complain. According to reports, McDonald's offered him some free food in an effort to make him happy, but that didn't, of course. Instead, he says he is now unable to work because of the undue mental anguish he suffered as a result of the napkin incident. Hey, wait a minute. Now, he has since filed a $1.5 million lawsuit against McDonald's. Personally, I think he should be sued for wasting our court's time with stupid, ignorant crap like that. I mean, secondly, I think any judge that doesn't throw the thing out immediately when it's presented to him should be kicked off the bench at the same time. Talk about stupidity. I'm appalled. John Bon Jovial, what's up next?
I got to tell you, I think that comes under the guise of WTF, question mark.
Can I get a hallelujah?
Yeah, hallelujah. Well, we had the pleasure of sitting down and speaking with a gentleman. You know, David, you had mentioned earlier that we don't always we really don't like to pre-record segments because of the spontaneity, but on occasion we have to. But we did have the distinct pleasure last week of sitting down on the phone with a gentleman who is very well known in our radio business, a gentleman named Bill Rock, very accomplished announcer, does a lot of work for NBC. He does a lot of work for Sirius XM Radio. I guarantee you that you have heard his voice many times on many different types of media. And so, David, I think that with that auspicious introduction there, I'm going to let you take it from here.
Our next guest is a world-class voice heard somewhere in the world every day of the year, primary voice on the NBC television network, as well as on Sirius XM satellite radio, as imaging voice for radio and TV facilities nationwide, and on radio and television commercials. In addition to being a familiar voice, he's an award-winning TV video producer with his own production company. He's listed in several Who and Who Who's Who listings around the country. His radio career spans four decades, including one decade that I'm personally familiar with. He's been both air personality and program director in many major markets, including the Albany, New York market, Boston, New Haven, and New York City. He was vice president of programming for Insilco Broadcasting in Oklahoma, New Orleans, Hartford, and Miami, and began his radio career at WWDJ back in 1970. I ran across this gentleman when I was working for him. He was my boss at WTRY AM and FM back in 1971 and 72. He's a graduate of Seton Hall University, has a BA in communications, and was inducted into the Seton Hall WSOU Hall of Fame in 1998. He's taken the time to join us now. Welcome, please, my old friend and former boss, Bill Rock. Bill, how are you?
Dave, I'm doing great. It's great to talk to you again, and I thank you very much for inviting me on your show.
Well, we appreciate that, and we appreciate you taking the time out of what I know is a rather busy schedule just from the items I just listed, and I know you have some other things going on, too. But we're glad to have you with us and glad to be able to pick your brain, get a little bit of an idea from your perspective as a radio programmer who obviously gets to play the records when they, well, they don't call them records anymore, forgive me, but you get to play the tunes when they get that far. We're interested in what it takes to get that far. Your advice, what you think is the bottom line, the basics that an aspiring talent today needs to make it in today's market.
Well, you know, Dave, it's interesting because I think that it doesn't really make any difference whether it was today or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, for that matter. Those kinds of things that are necessary for the artists to put together to get themselves prepared to try to climb the ladder to be successful in music is pretty much the same, although there have been drastic changes, and you and I have discussed this at one time or another, in the actual methodology of what one has to go through in terms of the technical aspects of it. Just in a quick review for that change, back in the day, as they say, there was radio and there were record sales. And as you alluded to records, there were records. These little objects that started out as 78s and then became LPs and then, of course, became 45 RPM records. And back in the early Top 40 days, which is really where this whole thing, you know, about being a quote-unquote rock star started with, of course, Elvis, the 45 records, of course, were the most important records to be sold, the singles. And it was record sales, and they were reported in places like Billboard and Cashbox and Gavin and other, you know, tip sheets and places like that. And then there were radio stations, and the radio stations got the records primarily from the promotion people, and they would take them around and say, this is a great record, and they'd say, it's selling here, it's selling there, it's being played here, it's being played there. Started off small and went bigger, of course, and that whole thing has completely changed now. In fact, radio itself, and you probably can address this better than I, has much less of a role to play in making a hit artist than it did years ago.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. As a matter of fact, it's almost turned around completely to where you have to be a hit artist to get played on radio.
That's true. It's turned into that kind of a situation, whereas before, radio was a proving ground. Now, it's interestingly enough, I alluded to Top 40 radio. Top 40, of course, being the top 40 most selling songs, and they could be very eclectic. You could have songs in different genres. Today it's so splintered and so, you know, so specified and so specific, and it's all narrowcast as to the way music gets programmed and played on the radio. But back then it had a lot to do with just, you know, gross record sales, and Todd Storrs, I think, had a great deal to do with paring that down to 40 records. It just seemed that was the most that he would watch people in jukeboxes, and that's actually how he came, you know, about putting that together, the concept of Top 40 radio. But that was pretty much the proving ground. And the stations that were playing, and interestingly enough, were the stations in the markets where these radio stations had really poor signals. Poor, and what I mean by that is they couldn't be heard all that much. therefore they didn't have that much listenership. But they played something that was new, and content is always king, as you know, in broadcasting. And they played a whole new sound that was rock and roll back in the 1950s, and of course they became huge successes. The next wave of that was FM. Radio stations would simulcast what they had, in other words, play the same programming on AM and FM if they owned AM and FM stations, because again, AM radio was king and FM was not. Well, what they did on FM when they had to separate back in 1965 from an FCC ruling, they found that they couldn't play the same programming, so what they did was they said, well, what do we have that's cheap that we can do? We don't have any commercials. We'll play music on FM. And, of course, FM became hugely successful because of that. Even though it's just a different technological platform, it was the programming that made it different. And the same thing holds true today, of course, for the Internet, because it's a whole new, different technological, you know, format. You also talked, of course, about satellite radio, which I have been in now for about, oh, a dozen or so years. I was on the 50s channel, the 60s channel, the country channel, two of the country channels, and started the Elvis channel as the first voice on the Elvis channel on Elvis radio 10 years ago this year, as a matter of fact. But the point I was trying to make is...
Congratulations on that. That's great.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's coming up this July. But that's the progression of how it happened. It was a proving ground for this sort of thing. What happened, of course, then with radio was the proliferation of all the different alternative media. Radio became much safer, and by being safer, what you talked about before, and that is they just began to play the hits. So instead of being the place where you went to get known, it was the place where you went once you were known. And so that's a major shift in how you get to be a quote-unquote star today. there's also other things. For instance, I mean, you've got the different shows that back in the day, back in the 50s, I think it was, you had Ted Mack's original Amateur Hour for television. And that was about it. Today you have American Idol, America's Got Talent, and a show that my voice is heard on quite often, The Voice on NBC. These are huge productions. They're massive. These are things that platforms that go worldwide. And not only that, but there's a whole new dimension to it. Now it's not only sound, it's sight. Sounds like Rod Sterling. Doug Sterling, rather.
Well, it's gotten to a point now where instead of radio breaking the hits, it's TV is starting to break the hits more and more, especially with AGT and The Voice and as you said, American Idol. Because even with the proliferation of channels, there's still a fairly narrow choice on television as compared to radio and other mediums such as YouTube and iTunes and that kind of thing.
Well, another phase of that evolution of ours as far as exposing artists was MTV. MTV, the guy that I had worked for originally at WNBC Radio, or actually I preceded him as the program director, and then he became the program director when I left to go back to working as a vice president of programming. Bob Pittman had worked with a guy named Les Garland and put together MTV. And because there was this whole new dimension of the visual, which became the music video, which became an extremely important part of this whole process. Whole new groups, that normally would not have been necessarily that popular on radio, suddenly became very popular on television because the visual aspect became as important as the audio. Back in the 50s, you could actually be positively ugly as long as you had a good sound. If you've noticed today that a lot of the artists, especially the female artists, are very beautiful, very pretty. And that seems to be the rule and not the exception. And that's another dimension that's involved with it, too.
Yeah, image is everything, as they say, and you're right. You don't see a lot of, how would we want it, politically correct, say, unattractive stars.
Perhaps a little more graphic. Less attractive, let's put it that way.
Yes.
But I was talking about people who aren't around anymore, so.
And I don't know how many times I've been told I had a great face for radio.
Oh, we all have. No,
that's probably why we are in radio. But
exactly.
you bring out a very good point, Bill, and that is the fact that as the times have changed, the mediums have changed, the technology has changed, the tools have changed, but the process is similar. It's just that I think you agree with me here that now with the advent of the indie artists taking over the market to a much larger extent than they were able to back in the early days of rock and roll or popular music, whatever genre. Now it's incumbent on the aspiring artist to learn the business even more than they ever did in the past and know all of these different facets, these different tools, as it were, so they know how to build a career and try to make it work for them.
Absolutely. First of all, there's an old adage, it's not even an adage, it's just a saying, it's three words, that I think applies to many industries, but it certainly applies to the entertainment industry and certainly the recording industry. Preparation meets opportunity, and that's the formula for success. Now, of course, the opportunities usually are not things that you can make. They usually happen to you, but the preparation is what you have control of, and the preparation is what helps you become what you eventually do become. It's the fulfilling prophecy, so to speak. It starts with talent. Now, I don't think anyone can be really, really successful as a performer unless they have talent. I think, you know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, most of the people most of the time, whatever that is. You can't fool everybody all the time. Not that talent is fooling somebody, but it is, in fact, creating a situation where you're an attraction to people, where you have a certain amount of charisma. And that's another aspect of this, that you can't make charisma. You have to have natural charisma. But there are varying degrees of that. You can be a good technician and not have that much charisma and still be successful at what you're doing. And, of course, successful is a very relative term, which we can talk about later as far as specifically about that, what that means. But getting back to the tools that you need, meaning anybody who wants to get into this business, again, starts with recognizing that you have talent. Now, there are people with talent who don't necessarily want to do anything with it, but there are people without talent who don't do want to do something with it. It's that balance between having talent and the desire and the passion to do something with it that's necessary as far as the next step is concerned. And then really important is the willingness to work and to work hard. I mean, you can be talented, you can have charisma, but if you're not very together and if you don't have any kind of a plan, chances are you're not going to get to, well, I used to have a friend of mine who used to say, if you haven't got a plan, any road will take you where you want to go. Anywhere will take you somewhere, but it won't take you necessarily where you want to go. So you have to have that willingness to work. And then you have to develop a style. And usually what happens is you listen to other people first before you get your own style, before you find your own voice, before you find yourself. Practice. Again, there's that old saying, the guy walking down the street in New York saying, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? And the guy goes, practice, man, practice.
Amen. And a point you brought out, I think it'd be carried one step further, and that's the fact that in your analogy of preparation and opportunity, oftentimes enough preparation helps create the opportunities or turn a situation into an opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And you also have to have luck. Who you know makes a difference, and what you just talked about has a lot to do with who you know. In other words, you meet people. You make contacts. You stay in touch with these contacts.
And that's something that a lot of these artists or the aspiring artists today don't realize, the fact not only meeting or making contact with these people, but getting to know them. I mean, let's face it, you're not going to become their best buddy. You're not going to go out drinking with them or out to dinner every week with them, but you can still create a relationship with them where they not only are aware of you, but they know you, and this is more likely to build into a successful business relationship.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm sure, Dave, you've run across this many times because you interview a lot of artists. It amazes me when I look back at the bios of very successful performers, but if you look back in their history, that they had worked with somebody who everybody else knew at that time, or knew somebody, or met somebody, or had some kind of an encounter early on in their career, which then led to perhaps them being thought of later on in their career, and helped them actually to with their own career. You know, they may, for instance, like to be more specific, an artist, a singer, a rock star, for lack of a better word, may have been a backup singer or a backup musician for somebody else who was well known, you know, years before that. I mean, that's what you're talking about, that sort of thing too. It's, as well as the people behind the scenes, of course, the people who are in management and the technical people and all the other people involved with that sort of thing. But as I mentioned before, imitation of others is really the way to start with. So you find your own style. You don't develop your own style right away. And getting back to that talent thing, by the way, there's two things you really need to be a recording artist. You need to have perfect pitch, which means that you can imitate whatever sound you hear. If somebody were to sing a note or you were to hear a note, you could hit that note immediately. Or you could play that note immediately, if you were a musician, for instance.
Right.
The other is rhythm. You can't play music without rhythm.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Well, you gotta add into that salesmanship as well.
Yeah, and not all God's children do have rhythm.
That's a proven fact. Now, Bill, there's one thing that not everybody knows about you. As a matter of fact, I didn't know it until just recently. And I think it's very interesting because you have spent, you've made a successful career from the broadcast side as a radio personality, as a program director, and so on. But what a lot of people don't know is you were also on the other side of the equation as a performing artist, as a musician. So you are uniquely qualified to, if not give advice, at least voice an opinion on what it takes in the way of making a career in music. And I think the word success is sometimes overused. I think success is going to be different to different people. Some people are going to be happy going into a local club or a piano bar and playing piano on Saturday nights for the locals. Some people want to go on and become Elvis Presley. And I think it's interesting that you're able to look at this from both sides of the table. What would you, in our last minutes here, what would you advise a young, aspiring musician who came up to you and said, Bill, I respect your experience. What do I need to do to make a career in the music business?
Well, it's interesting. In my own particular situation, I had been interested in music since I was a kid. In fact, I started playing the clarinet when I was 10 years old. Not classical clarinet. I was a Benny Goodman fan. It was a big band clarinetist back in the 30s. And I was exposed to that, you know, through my father, who just loved the big band era and that sort of thing. Got started playing in rock and roll bands when I was 12 years old. I realized at that point also I loved radio. I loved, you know, broadcasting. There came a point, this is not really answering your question, but as far as I'm concerned, it's probably one of those things that at least you should take into consideration. I weighed the two. I said, I probably can do much better being in broadcasting. And this wasn't the reason I went into broadcasting, by the way. I went into it because I loved it. But I also realized, you know what, I'm probably a pretty good musician, but I think I can probably go a lot farther doing something else. So I remained my vocation was broadcasting, but my avocation and my if you will, passion was to be a musician. I remained a musician all my life. I've played with numerous bands and so forth. It's hard to say. There's no formula as to how to make it and how to be a rock star or whatever. I mean, that takes so many different things into consideration. But the things that I spoke about earlier, a willingness to work, developing practice, desire and passion, knowing that you have talent, figuring out whether or not you have charisma. I have a friend of mine who's an Elvis tribute artist in Florida who I played in his band a couple of years back. As a matter of fact, he has a 13-piece band. He asked me to MC his show and also play in the band, which I did, which was a real thrill for me. But he has a saying, he says, you know, there's 40,000 Elvis tribute artists out there, and there's only about, you know, a handful of them that really make any money at doing, you know, successfully making it a significant career. He said, but everybody can find at least one person who thinks they're great. and you have to kind of figure that out. If you're doing really well at the local, you know, Holiday Inn or the local club, as you say, but there's 15 people telling you that you're great, you need like 15 million people to do what you might want to do eventually. So that's, I think knowing yourself, I think, is part of it. But don't get too practical about it either. Do it because you love doing it. That's the main reason to do it. Don't do it because you want to be a rock star. Do it because you think you want to do this more than anything else, and you love doing it. And the other will eventually follow through. Don't worry about how much time off, you know, vacations, how much you're going to get paid, you know, that sort of thing. Also, don't go work on your timing. Don't go for the gold before you're ready to do that. Work on your craft. Make sure that you know what you're doing. And what you're doing is going to turn a lot of people on, and not just the people who you know are going to turn on, the people you don't know, and be your own best, your own worst critic. In other words, look at yourself and say, am I really doing something that I really think that a lot of people are really going to enjoy? So be honest and realistic about that as well.
Very good, and I do appreciate you taking the time to come and sit with us. I'd like to have you come back sometime in the near future. We can talk more. Bill, before you leave, tell the people how they can follow you. I know you're on Sirius XM Elvis Radio. Tell us how we can find you and follow you. I'm sure you have some online connections.
Yeah, well, I have a website, of course. It's BillRock.com, which is about my business and what I do. But also I have a Facebook, which I primarily use for the Elvis Radio more than anything else, because it's my way to be able to communicate a little more personally with, you know, individuals in terms of what I do on the show on Saturday nights.
Welcome
the show is
to
very
my
much
website.
About the Elvis
I'm
band. I've always done that. When I was on WYNY in New York, I did that for quite a few years. I would put people on the air. But I wouldn't put them on the air to say nonsensical things, and I'm not putting anybody down for that. What I'm saying is I put people on the air to say things that are going to be of interest to other people. So that's why I encourage people to tell their stories about their life, for instance, to relate to the lyrics of an Elvis song. Because what they're really doing is they're giving a dramatic account of their own life, and it's something that everybody can share. And it's real reality as opposed to contrived reality like we see on television.
I heard several people tell me that if we had had some of these reality shows, the competitions, the talent competitions that we have on now, there are several major stars of the past that would have never made it, which may or may not be true. But, Bill, again, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. We will be listening to Elvis Radio. Keep us posted of your exciting stuff, because I know every now and then you come up with something that really catches my attention, and I try to pass this on to my listeners, too. We always repost your weekly postings of what you're having on Saturday nights, and, again, we look forward to having you back. It's been a ball. Thank you so much, Bill. Bill Rock.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Well, hey, listen, we didn't exactly mean to cut it off like that, but for some reason
That was a tasteful fade.
Yeah, it was supposed to fade. It wasn't supposed to cut it off. But, hey, since we did, let's find the guy who wrote this song and see what the man is doing. Is this the man?
How can I be the man when you be the man? This is what understand. This is what I don't understand.
No, man, you the man.
Listen, let me ask you something.
Rob Parisi.
Have you put your clothes back on? Because when you try to do your shows naked, they delay your shows by an hour. And I keep telling you, if you just like give up doing your shows naked and dress, can get on the air on time.
I don't know why you don't listen to me.
I try to give you good legal advice, and you just don't listen.
You know, Rob, we're in two separate studios, and, you know, you just created a vision, and now I think I'm going to listen.
I am sorry. I apologize.
And that's the naked truth. How you doing, Rob?
I'm good. If I was any better, I'd be twins.
If you was any better, it'd be illegal.
I'd be twins. I mean, I'd have to be twins. I mean, I'm good. How about you?
I don't know if the world's ready for two of you, but I know they don't want two of me.
Listen, it's been 37 years. I'm still funky and I'm still white. So I mean, how could I complain? I mean, you know, I've sustained. I have, you know.
And you have laid down some pretty funky music over the years too, all kinds of stuff. I don't know
we'll
if a lot of people
that.
Are aware, but we've tried to. You've done some great. I feel uncomfortable calling modern jazz. It's kind of pop standard with jazz undertones, but you've done some great stuff, and I love your music, but. Play That Funky Music, White Boy, was what started it all, and you got to tell us the one overpowering question that everybody wants to know. How the hell did you come up with that idea?
We were desperate. Honest to God. I mean, we were a rock band, and here we're surrounded by disco. I mean, I felt like...
Right.
You know, we were like in a foxhole, and there was like a bunch of stuff around us that was like saying, this is going to take over. And so we did as much as we could to take some disco records that we heard and beef them up and play them more like Led Zeppelin would do. That's the way I like it. Just imagine that. But it was working. I mean... That's what we did. We did That's the Way I Like It, but we just like we did it like Led Zeppelin would do it, and it was going over. And so I said, this is what we just need to do, because I can't book us 35 songs, disco songs, and then 35 songs, rock songs, in two different kinds of clubs. We have to come up with one genre that we do that works in both rooms. And that's what we did. And in the meantime, I wrote Play That Funky Music, go figure, you know.
I can understand the writing.
I didn't mean to stop
lyrics.
The show here. I'm sorry.
No. You're doing just what we wanted you to.
All right. Okay.
The instrumentation, the musical part of that was just incredible. It is what you said. It's almost heavy metal disco. If anybody can picture that.
I'm telling you something. When the Beatles got together, they had that rhythm section sound. And mm-hmm. I grew up close to Detroit, where the Funk Brothers were, and they had that.
Okay.
They had a rhythm section sound. But even Led Zeppelin, when they did their thing, I mean, Jimmy Page, they worked as a great. There's got to be a part counterpart, either like the downbeat and then the offbeat. It's got to be like a great counterpart situation with your rhythm section. And I was always interested in the mathematics of that. And we all grew up, Ohio players, they were from around Cincinnati. They had that too.
Right.
We all knew, even the James Gang, they were funky. Funk 49 was their first song that, you know, Joe Walsh, he's funky. They are.
That was a great album.
Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nail, they come from our area. You know, Buzz Skaggs come from here. you know, a lot of...
Yeah, you got some...
it's funky.
You got some great talent back there.
We got some great talent here that came from here because of that influence. Chrissy Hynde from The Pretenders, she's from here. Devo,
I didn't know.
No, yeah, she's from here. Devo's from here.
Must be something major.
Well, it's that rock funk thing. I'm telling you, everybody gets that ends up making history from here. And there have been plenty from here that have made history. You know, the Letterman?
Definitely.
Remember that band? They were from here.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean,
and
we've got, like, the Skyliners, the Dull Vikings. Those guys that had those doo-wop records, they had Whispering Bells, and they had Come Go With Me.
Oh, yeah.
Those records were cut.
Wait
a second. Those records were by guys that were in the Air Force in a patrol. They were at a barracks here, and they formed the band. But the thing about them that I really appreciate is they were recorded in a ballroom at the Sheraton Hotel downtown Pittsburgh with some outboard gear that they had at the time. And if you listen to those records, they sound good.
Oh, absolutely. Tremendous sound, yeah.
Yeah, just go
absolutely.
Back and listen to those records and just imagine. They were cut in the ballroom of a hotel in downtown Pittsburgh. And guys that were in the Air Force.
Before you get out of here, and we, as I said, we are running a little bit short on time, ladies and gentlemen. We started late, and we've got about 5 minutes left. I do want to touch on a couple of things that our audience should know about you, and that is the fact that you are involved in a little bit more than just playing funky music. You have a major cause back in your home area, back in Mingo Junction, and you are working on a project for a college scholarship fund. There it is. I almost lost the phrase. Tell us what you're doing with this college scholarship fund, because what you're doing here is beautiful. You're paying it forward.
Yeah, we started a scholarship fund for the kids at the high school that I went to. They've conglomerated into a bigger high school, and we started a scholarship fund for them to help, you know, somebody every year to get an education further, and that's what we're doing. And I'm going back in August, and we're going to do a concert with all my good friends back there who have donated their time, too. I mean, this is nice. You know, people just come together. And we're going to have a good time. It's going to be great. I'm going to see friends of mine I haven't seen for a long time, but we'll get together, have a great time, raise a lot of money, hopefully, and, you know, see a lot of people and friends, you know. Great.
I've been following absolutely. I've been following your comments and your posts. Now you are on Facebook as Rob Parisi, for those who haven't already found you. And now this is all going down in Mingo Junction. Am I correct?
Yes. Right in the town at the Knights of Columbus Hall. We hope to get 800 people and have people lined up outside, we hope.
Well, I was going to try and see if we could help you break the fire laws, how many people you could cram in there. How much of this now is going to be open to the public?
Everything.
Everything.
Just
so
come. Everything that we're doing, it's open to the public.
Give us the dates now. We know that it's in Mingo Junction, and somehow I figure we won't have trouble finding the venue, but what are the dates?
August 10th. If you have MapQuest. August 10th, Mingo Junction, Ohio. If you're in South Dakota right now and you're listening, you're going to have a long trip.
Well, I'm just looking at it from a purely personal point. I want to thank you for scheduling my birthday party for me there. I just hope I can make it because August 10th is my birthday, and
I have a show
that day as well. I have
Come
a show
on,
that
we need, we need to fly you in, man.
Would that be a colossal?
I'm going to send my Learjet.
We have 90 seconds. I was just told we have 90 seconds left. That would be colossal. Can you imagine the panic of doing the show live from the
God, it's National Panic Day. It's National
Absolutely.
Panic Day. You know what I'm going to do?
Hey, Rob,
I'm gonna
go ahead.
I'm going to send my pilot with my Learjet to pick you up.
I'll be waiting at the airport. That's a promise. We've got 60 seconds, Rob. I'm going to have to wrap this up before they throw us out of here. But listen, I do appreciate your patience and coming in to work with us. Thank you so much for being a part of this, and I wish you all the best at my birthday party. I hope you raise $1 million up there for that. Keep in touch because we're going to help you promote that too. Thanks also to James Arena, author of First Ladies of Disco and Legends of Disco, who brought Rob with him today for the show. Also to Alpha Anderson, formerly of Chic, and Joe Harris.
Yes, sir. Well, I just want to let you know that we want you to be sure to join us for the David Bowers Awards next Sunday, March 10th at 2 p.m. Eastern. That's going to be 11 a.m. Pacific time, when our guest will be blues rocker Frank Robert, and he'll be debuting his new CD, Ride the Iron Road, and rocker John Sweet also debuting his new CD, plus country songwriter Anthony Smith. He's going to be holding Rockstar 101, and that is it, and we'll see you next month. Thank you, everybody.